This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio. In observance of Shabbat, the Jewish day of rest, the following episode of Finding Your Bliss was recorded on Wednesday, March 12th.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and I'm delighted to have author Amy Fish back on the program with her latest book, which is outstanding, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you, Judy.
And it's a real departure from her other two books. This one has been 6 years in the making, and it's called One in 6 Million, The Baby by the Roadside and the Man Who Retraced a Holocaust Survivor's Lost Identity. Let me just tell you a little bit about the book. You're going to want to stay with us. This story and the telling of it is a remarkable one. One in 6 Million is about Maria, who was 8 months old in 1942 when a childless couple found her wrapped up in a blanket at the side of the road near Krosno, Poland. A note pinned to the blanket stated only her first name and her date of birth. The couple picked up Maria and raised her, but she grew up longing for identity and connection. Who was she, and what had happened to her family? A tale of unexpected coincidences, astonishing revelations, and more than a little luck. One in 6 Million is an amazing story of lost and found identity. The book comes out on Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. And before this book, Amy wrote some other books. She's the author of Honeymoon Sneakers, A Cautionary Tale, I Wanted Fries With That, How to Ask for What You Want and Get What You Need, and The Art of Complaining Effectively. And Fries, by the way, was named by the CBC as one of 40 works of creative nonfiction to watch out for, and was a pick for 14 books for those that love to laugh. Both of those things happened in 2019. Amy is also a staff reviewer and interviewer for Hippocampus Magazine for Creative Nonfiction. She's also the ombudsman at Concordia University in Montreal. Amy, again, congratulations on this incredible achievement and welcome back to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So, Amy, someone once said to you when you were giving a talk, unrelated to this, would you come to our Christmas party and do this act? And you said, right. What act? This is a workshop. Amy Fish, you know I think you're hilarious and that you really could be a stand-up comedian or a daytime talk show host. We've talked about this. I said this to you for years. You could be on Saturday Night Live, and many of your books have enjoyed the benefit of your incredible humor, and you've always had this delightful gift. There were even a few humorous lines in One in 6 Million, and I actually screenshotted them, because you can't help it.
I know. That's
who you are, right?
I know.
However, in this book, in this latest work, you've really taken a deep dive and a huge pivot with this One in 6 Million. The book is not funny. The subject is not funny. There's hope in it. There's lots of hope. And you're a light, you are a light, and your book is a light, but it's not funny. It's serious, it's compelling, it actually made me cry many times. Mm. You're a natural storyteller, we know that, but you've also done exacting, stringent, and meticulous research. I think you've become an instant expert in genetic testing and DNA and genealogy, and you've made this fascinating narrative come to life. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about your brainchild and what motivated you to write One in 6 Million. Also, what a great title.
Thank you. What motivated me to write One in 6 Million is two things. One is that I grew up going to Jewish day school, going to Brandeis University, really strong Jewish education, and I never knew that Holocaust survivors are still finding their families now in 2025. And I thought, if I don't know this, I'm sure many people don't know this, and it needs to be told. People need to know that in a lot of ways, and for a lot of people, it's not too late. Yes, you're not going to find your parents if you're 80 or 90 years old, but the stories about finding a long-lost sister or a cousin or an aunt, they're still around. Yeah. And for Maria, the subject of my story, she was able to find over 100 cousins alive and well and living in Tel Aviv. And she was flown there to meet them all. I mean, once I took one step into the story, Judy, I just couldn't. It was like a rabbit hole that I couldn't let go.
Yes.
So that was one thing. And the other thing is Stanley Diamond, the hero. Yes. Here's a genealogist who is a guy who was a sales guy, sold his business like so many people do. And instead of taking up stamp collecting or pickleball, he starts researching family trees and becomes a worldwide expert. And he's, out of the goodness of his heart, helping people reconnect with their families. I mean, come on. This is why I love true stories, because I just find them crazier than fiction.
Of course. Of course. And you had this fateful meeting with Stanley Diamond at the Shiva of your uncle Avi, who was almost more like a grandfather.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
He was
yes.
a beloved late great uncle.
Yes.
Related to your mother. And for those who don't know what a Shiva is, just to share this, a Shiva means seven and refers to the 7-day mourning period immediately following a close family member's funeral. And the question is, I know that coincidence, or Stanley used to call it throughout the book, beshert, or fate, plays a huge role in this story. So first of all, how did that pivotal meeting with Stanley change the trajectory of your life?
Thank you for recognizing that, because it really did change the trajectory of my life. As you said, I had written only funny things and very vignette, you know, something that popped into my head. And when I met Stanley at the Shiva, how it went was we were kind of taking turns with the guests. So it would be similar to a wake or anything where there's sort of the main family and then people who knew the deceased and are coming to pay their respects, but don't really have a connection to anyone else there. And here walks in this older gentleman with a mustache and sits himself down. And it was sort of my turn to go and chit chat with him. And I'm rolling my eyes. Okay, sure. And he says, you know, I do family tree history, and I stifle a yawn and I say, all right, give me an example. And he tells me this compelling story. And I thought about it all night, all night. I said, this story needs to be told and I'm the one who needs to tell it. And I reached out to him the next day and I said, has anyone ever offered to write your story? And he said, many people have, but I've always said no. And he said, but you're my family, because he knew family history. He sort of knew where him and I fit, you know, in which branches of the tree. And so, and I don't remember right at the moment, are we third cousins or once removed, whatever it is. And he knew that. So he said, for that reason, I trust you, Amy, to tell my story.
As well, you were a tried and true author
right.
who had published numerous
right,
books.
Right, right.
So he knew
yes,
on
yes.
many levels, this,
yes,
was,
yes.
this was kosher, right? This was okay. Right?
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And you meet him. And I have to go back for a bit because, in fact, it all really started with your Uncle Avi from the very beginning, I think, because he was one of the first people that told you, Amy, that you should be a writer because you had so much to say. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he even helped you print out those 2,500 copies of your first book.
That's right.
I think that was the purple book.
That's
which
right.
You used to fish out of your purse at IGA or a supermarket
yes.
when someone asked about the purple book, and you had a copy right there in your handbag.
Exactly. That is 100% the story.
What are your memories of that? Just of Uncle Avi, like noticing, like how great is that when someone notices what your gift and what your calling is?
Yeah. He said to me, you know, he was a man of very few words, and he said, you have so much to say, write a book. And he had published books for some of his friends. He was a philanthropist. And one of the generous things he did for people is guided them through publishing. He actually had a micro press, a very small printing house where he would do these books. He printed a book for his urologist and for a photographer and a golf book. And he sort of had this very eclectic taste. And then he offered me the opportunity, and I knew nothing about books. I didn't even know you were supposed to edit it. You know, I wrote the book, I printed it out, and I said, here we go. And then what happened with that book is that people wanted it. It was a very lucky problem to have, but I said, okay, I better learn how to do this properly. And then subsequent to publishing my first book, I took a writing class.
That's right. That's right. So Uncle Lovey passed away at 93 years old. And that section in the book was also very poignant. That was one of the sections that made me cry, not only because you were grieving, but because your children were grieving. You talk about your daughter, Liberty, in the book.
And
you really, really captured the sadness and the loss that you were all feeling.
Thank you.
He's such a pivotal part of your story. And it's so interconnected because really, the shiv of your beloved uncle led you to meeting Stanley Diamond. I also just found it very poignant in that section, just that you and your sister helped Avi's daughter, Lulu, at her father's shiva, your great uncle, Avi, much like she helped you and your sister 5 years earlier when your beloved mother died. Can you tell us about that? Because I found that so fascinating that you kind of took over for her just the way she had taken over for you.
Well, the way she likes to tell it is that she came in from Toronto and my mother was dying, as some people do, over a long period of time. So it was about 3 weeks of any minute now, any minute now, any minute now. So my cousin Lulu came in from Toronto and kept going back home. And she said at a certain point, I grabbed her wrist and said, you cannot leave me. And I don't remember that moment. But she said she just felt it sort of course through her. And she stayed in Montreal.
Unbelievable, eh?
Yeah.
Unbelievable what family is.
And you know, Judy, by the way, unbelievable that even in your darkest moments, you know what your bliss is. I knew who my guidepost was, and I knew that I needed her there. And even though I don't remember the conversation, I somehow knew how to get what I needed.
Wow. Incredible, eh? There's so many coincidences and revelations that led you to writing this book. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about something that's not even in the book that led to all of this. But it was the writing conference that also changed your life. Mm-hmm. And I love when you gave this talk that was very well received, like standing ovations and applause galore. Mm-hmm. And you tell the story of how you met someone at this writing conference. You met someone there, a woman who became like your soul sister. And you discovered that you were both knitters. The woman worked in education administration.
Oh, Angie. Yes, yes.
You work in education. Her daughter plays basketball, and on and on and on. And then she said to you, you know, 3 years ago, my mother passed away from dementia. You told her you're never going to believe this, but 3 years ago, my mother passed away from dementia. And you describe how she opened her arms and you fell into them, and you've been friends ever since.
Yeah.
And at that poignant moment during your talk, as you told this, the whole audience just stopped and began applauding like crazy. And I thought about this as I was reading this book and reading about you and what the trajectory was leading up to this moment of writing this most important and significant book. And it also reminded me, Amy, what an incredible speaker and host you are and how great you are at all of this.
Thank you, Judy.
No, truly, because it's all coming together, which to me is what when bliss, like when you get the shivers. What I love about this book for you is not only that you have written a seminal book really on genealogy and the Holocaust and memorializing Stanley and Maria's story whilst becoming such a prolific writer, but you're also getting to talk about your work and to lift people up and make them laugh and cry, which is what you were born to do. So how much do you love this part of it, speaking about it even after you've written it?
You know, it's funny. This is just the beginning, right? Like I'm just starting my interviews. You're one of my first ones. So I'm still very fresh. And Fries is 6 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing interviews 6 years later for that. Not as often, but I do get called. It's sort of that balance of keeping it fresh versus being super fresh. Do you know what I'm saying? So like I might stumble a little bit here and there, and it's still at the point where I probably will get off this interview and be like, oh, I forgot to mention, because I'm not rehearsed. But on the other hand, I'm so fresh and enthusiastic. And for Fries, you know, I'm telling the stories, telling the stories, telling the stories. So I won't forget, but it might not be as zippy. You know what I mean?
You're always zippy. You're always zippy. Let's get back to 1 in 6 million. When you first started to talk to Stanley, did you know at the time that this was going to become a very important book? I know you did 100 interviews with him. But did you have a feeling when you first started interviewing him that there was a story here in this story of Maria and Stanley and all of it? Did you have a feeling?
Okay. So what happened was I met Stanley at the shiva and I called him. What I thought was going to happen was I thought Stanley would give me his archives and I would write the book. I did not imagine that I would have to spend or be lucky enough to spend so many hours interviewing him. And it was a combination of our friendship that grew and my inexperience. Because now that I've learned how to interview properly, at the beginning, Judy, I didn't even record the interviews. That's how green I was. I figured I have a notepad. If he says something important, I'll write it down. Right. Now, of course, I've struggled to do that. And I ended up having to go back to school and do a master's in fine arts and creative nonfiction to learn how to properly write this book. And right away, I learned about interviewing techniques and I realized how funny it was, how off the mark I was. And that's part of the reason it took so long. But what was beautiful about that is our friendship really grew. And so the interviews became, you know, almost conversations. And even when the book was written, I would still speak to Stanley. He just passed away.
I know. I'm so sorry.
But I spoke to him, I think, on the Thursday before, and he passed away on a Sunday or Monday. So we were still in very close contact.
Wow. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I also love the way you structured this book of Stanley first, and then the book of Maria, the book of Rivka, and then the final chapter, One More Thing Before Acknowledgements. What made you structure it this way? And who convinced you in a much later draft to include yourself, Amy, as a voice in the narrative? That was great.
The structure of the book is 100% my editor, Jill. So this book is put together by Goose Lane Editions, which is in Fredericton and is one of the oldest publishing houses in Canada.
Wow.
And they actually bought my book post October 7th. They were interested in a Jewish story. It's really a very global story, but most of the characters in the book are Jewish, and it's about Maria finding her Jewish identity and also paying homage to her parents that were Polish and that adopted her, found her on the side of the road and scooped her up. So anyway, the Goose Lane Editions bought the story and they gave me an editor who was like, you know, I always say to her, the editors you see in movies where they just work so well together, like the skies open. I mean, she was so helpful and so amazing. And we had to rewrite the entire book, I have to tell you. The entire book. Yeah. And mainly it related to structure because I had grouped it more thematically. And she really wanted it more Stanley and then Maria and then let's bring it together. And it really, I love what she did.
Oh, that's so great. You even write in the acknowledgements, you hope for your next book that you could have her again as an editor because she was so amazing.
Oh, yeah. I tell her that. We're still in touch, too. I speak to her regularly, too. And I tell her it would be very hard to work on a project without her because I just really like the way her brain works. And she's a structure master. And I'm so weak in that area.
Wow.
We really work well together. She helped me. Like, I love research, for sure. But she helped direct and kind of refine some of my research. So as far as putting myself in the book, that was always the plan. It was just a question of how much. And that was a balance that we kind of worked through together as the project progressed.
Another thing that I loved, and this is on your Instagram, Amy Fish Writes Everyone, which we'll tell you about again at the end of the show, but that someone makes this comment about being an overnight sensation. And I love that you address this, that this was not an overnight sensation story, much like Karen Kane, who took, you know, 20 years to become an overnight sensation
right.
of many baby steps on Point Shoes. It's the same thing, right? There were many twists and turns, and this was one of them. So can you tell us a little bit about this? Because I think this is so encouraging for writers to hear that this was 100 interviews. This took 6 years. This is not something you just dashed off. You know, at a writer's, you know, retreat or something,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So this book, 1 in 6 Million, is the exact opposite of an overnight sensation because what happened was I started interviewing Stanley and I started putting a book together. Then I realized that I was in over my head because I didn't know how to tell a story that happened to someone else. I knew how to tell my own story, but I didn't want it to read like, you know, I met Stanley on Wednesday and it was raining and Stanley told me blah, blah, blah. I wanted to immerse. And don't you think in this book, you're just in there with them? Like, I just wanted to be immersed. And
Completely.
And I was like, I got to learn how to do this. So I looked and I found an MFA in creative nonfiction in King's College, which is in Halifax, but you do it remotely, mainly by distance. And you apply with a project. It's very practical. And I had my project. So I applied with a project. You choose your mentor. And I chose a mentor, Ken McGugan, who is an expert in, of all things, the Northwest Passage. And he writes these giant historical quests. But I was like, I have a quest book. And that's how I kind of modeled it. You see?
Yes,
and so right. I had an amazing, fabulous writing group, great mentor, great supervisor. And that was the first thing. And then the first summer, I had my proposal. I'm ready to go on submission, which is when you send your book out for publishers. And my agent called me and said, I'm leaving the industry. I'm not going to be an agent anymore.
Good Lord.
And I said, you're kidding. And at first, I was super confident. I was like, well, someone else will pick me up from her agency. And I had everything ready and I redid my website and I'm all organized waiting for my phone to ring. And then I get a letter saying, effective immediately, you are no longer. I never even had a chance to pitch. Oh. They didn't even know I had a project ready to go on sub.
Oh.
And a friend of mine, Lara, one of my writing really partners in crime, saw on Twitter that it wasn't just me. Like a whole bunch of people got cut from the agency, whether it was too old, too young, too this, too that. We never uncovered it. But now, on top of finishing the master's degree, finishing the book, and I have a full-time job, now I have to find a new agent. So I'm just pitching and pitching and pitching and pitching until ultimately someone wrote me back and said, you're not for me, but I'm going to send you to someone else in my agency. And the second person said, you're not for me, but I'm going to send you to someone else in my agency. And the third guy said, let's go. And so my agent, Michael Levine, told me I am the first person in 20 years, Judy, that he has taken off the slush pile.
Oh, wow. Something grabbed him.
Something in the story.
You have an amazing agent.
I was really lucky. I was so lucky, Judy. Like I would have never pitched him. I mean, that was out of my league, right? I would have never attempted to get Michael Levine, never. I was so lucky that the subject matter appealed to him and that somebody in his agency said, I know who this is for.
Mm, that is so unbelievable. Like all of these are like pretty exciting moments, not just the achievement of having done it so swimmingly well, but just every, you know, all of this, you know, even the agent, all of it, but also the lesson for people that, you know, every rejection is God's protection just because it didn't work at the beginning, right? So it led to, you kept going.
You know, I write this Substack every Monday called Persistence for Writers. Yeah. Okay. And what made me decide to do it is because I started to realize that sometimes the difference between what we are talking about, overnight success and not being published at all, is just who keeps going and who quits. Because like, I don't quit. From the minute I walked into that MFA program, I was going to get my book published. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think in my entire cohort so far, so we graduated in 2023, I think there are less than 5 books. I think there are 3 or 4 books and we're a good 60 people.
Wow.
But most people just don't do it. They leave it. That was never going to be me. Like I was going to pitch and pitch and pitch and pitch until someone was going to take it.
And also the fact that you found the MFA program, a lot of people would have said, well, it's just too overwhelming. It's too much. I can't do this. I'm going to change subjects. I'm going to do something else. You were determined so much so that you went back and got a master's. How great is that?
I know. It's crazy. When I got the book and I held it in my hands, you know what my thought was? This was such a grind. It was such a grind. It was just a lot of work. And somebody once told me that when you're reading a book, you can't tell which chapters came easily to the author and which chapters they really choked out, right? Yeah. And I was like, that's such a good point because I remember what was so hard for me to get. But you can't tell reading it.
No, not at all. I know what was hard to the suspense of Maria, the painstaking frustration of the twists and turns and dead ends that didn't work. And you're like, you want to kill you. You're like, please help this woman make this happen. And I did love that Stanley Diamond, may he rest in peace, was this retired ceiling salesman and where he was the retired ceiling salesman in Lebanon in all these different places. And it was like, wait, a Jewish person can't go to these places.
Yeah.
How did he become this leading? You've got to read it, guys, to understand what it is about Stanley Diamond that enabled him to do all of this so incredibly well. And then he really did this dreams have no expiration date situation in midlife. Mm-hmm. He founded the largest database of Jewish Polish records in the world. He even helped Gwyneth Paltrow and Doug Emhoff and many other celebrities find their family tree. And he did so in his second career. What do you think he loved about this work so much and helping people in this way? Because he was very passionate about this work. He wouldn't stop.
Yeah, he wouldn't stop. He worked 14, 15 hours a day, even till his last day.
Wow.
I think his passion was driven by righting these cosmic wrongs that families were separated because of wars and because of anti-Semitism and all these horrors. And he just wasn't going to let that rest. So I think that was one thing. I think Stanley was a puzzle guy, you know, a puzzle solver. I think he treated this almost like, I say in the book, like a Sudoku or you know, people like to do the little mini crossword and the connections and all that on New York Times. I think for him, this was another way of solving puzzles. And I think, like me, and I connected with him on this, he was a researcher at heart. He just wanted to get to the bottom of it.
Yes.
The other thing too, and I mentioned this in the book, is that Stanley at a certain point had somebody write to him and say, I've had your child. And he had a son that was unaccounted for.
I know that. Yes. Yes.
And I said to him, can I include that?
Yes.
And he said, yes, you can. And I actually have, Judy, he gave me copies of the documents that he received relating to that. Mm. I always wondered if that fueled him, if he thought that maybe if he kept going in family tree research and DNA, that his son would reach out to him. To be fair, he said that wasn't part of it. But I always kind of wondered, because that happened when Stanley was very young. He was in his early 20s. And I always wonder if that kind of set the tone for him. And he didn't want other people to be separated from their families the way he was. Mm-hmm. So from a psychological point of view, I think that fueled him as well.
Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible. And you never know. The story's never over.
That's
even when the book is written. So we don't know.
That's it. That's it.
Another part of the book that felt very blissful to me was how altruistic the volunteer genealogists in the book were.
I mean, how inspiring is that?
I mean, it's unbelievable, giving so much of their time to help families reconnect, volunteering, especially during dark times. And I'm seeing this a lot in our community now, people giving of their time and their service to help be a light and make the world a better place. Can you speak to this? Because I love that in the book.
Well, I feel very passionately about that. Like when I see people posting negativity over and over again on social media, I can't take it.
I know.
And I want to say to them, what are you doing to make the world a better place today? What are you doing? And I write about that all the time. It's a big topic for me. I want to know, are you baking a banana bread for someone? Are you calling a lonely person? Are you sending a card? What are you doing?
Exactly.
Instead of looking around at everyone else and what they should be doing, I think it's okay to turn a little inward. What's interesting about this opportunity is that it's a volunteer opportunity where you don't have to leave your house.
Totally.
For people who are more introverted or who are, for physical reasons, can't get out.
Right.
These people
How
are
great.
On the computer.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I love also, Amy, at the end of the book, you offer questions for book clubs and book club discussions.
Yeah.
This book, guys, is really, it's not just read the book. This is a book that is going to live on. This is definitely a book that you have to bring into your book clubs and create a book club over this book. I'm telling you, one of the things you talk about is genetic testing and how it's grown in popularity over the past decade. Is it a good thing? Is it dangerous? It's just fascinating. There's so much in here. I want to go back to your experience in writing this book. So for years, you were scared to visit Poland. And you say you went to a Jewish day school, you went to a Jewish high school, but you were very frightened.
Yes.
And it was during a layover in Munich that you thought it was finally time to go. So you went by yourself and you were the only Jewish person. And after that trip, you said you'd never do that again alone. And finally, you got your opportunity to go to Poland again with your husband, David, after October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to what that was like? And I especially love that when you talk about your reaction, it was not one of sadness and despair, but it was different than what you had anticipated. Can you describe what your reaction was when you were there? Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break, back with Finding Your Bliss and author Amy Fish when we come back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio AM 740. And just before the break, I was asking you, Amy, if you could describe what it was like going back to Poland and how your reaction was very different than what you thought it would be?
It was completely different than I anticipated. I think for me, understanding the history was so powerful, mm-hmm. and the feeling that the war is over, that the resistance worked, that we yes. got out, that there yes. was a gift shop, that yes. there was a guy selling soft drinks. Like, yes. we don't have to be scared here anymore. Yes. And for me, that was really empowering. And I've been invited, actually, to the Jewish Arts and Culture Festival in Krakow, and I'm going back to Poland in June to actually talk about this book down the street from Auschwitz-Birkenau.
Oh my God, Amy.
So it's just brought me to places I never thought I would have such a connection to. I never dreamed. The other interesting thing is that I didn't understand that the death camps, actually everyone died off the train. I didn't get that. I always thought that the trains had kind of, you could go this way, you could go that way, you might get mm-hmm. lucky. But when I was there, we went to a camp where everyone died. They killed 500,000 people. No one survived. There were no barracks. The camp is tiny because they didn't need to keep anybody. The train took you right to the crematorium. And I was so shocked. And I said, oh my God, I wrote this incorrectly in the book. And I called my editor from there and said, like, I have to make it. It was very stop the presses. Like, the book was on its way. And I said, I'm when I come home, I have to change this one thing. Anyway, the craziest thing is I come home, I check in the manuscript, and I actually had written it correctly. Wow. But I didn't understand it viscerally.
Yeah. Viscerally.
Do you know what
viscerally.
I mean?
Yeah.
I reported it. Yes, death camps, yep, people, But until I stood there, Judy, until I stood in the place where this happened, until mm-hmm. I, what they call bore witness, that's how they term it there, I didn't understand it in my bones. And so it was just pivotal, not what I expected at all.
Oh boy. And it's there's so much reverberation right now also. Like, this book mm-hmm. is so timely because of what has happened, not only the horrible tragedy of October 7th, but what's happened in its aftermath, this worldwide anti-Semitism. This is such an important book on so many levels mm-hmm. and right now. Mm-hmm. More than ever before.
And the anti-Semitism, I mean, it touches me personally because the synagogue where my husband had his bar mitzvah had something thrown through the window. Mm-hmm. And the high school I went to as well had some vandalism. So it, for me and for many people in my community, it feels very close.
Yeah.
And so what do we do about that? But what we do is we think about stories that are optimistic, that are hopeful, and yes. ways that we can reunite families, and ways that we can bring people together, yes. and ways that we can create dialogue and create community. And we just can't, the sadness is too much to bear.
100%. And you are bringing people together. And I'm going to save this at the end as well, but I have to say it here, is that there is an incredible book launch in Toronto on April 1st and in Montreal on April 3rd. But what you've managed to do with that Montreal book launch, which I just read about today, is that a friend of yours helped you with this. You are gathering 20 Holocaust survivors, and this dear friend of yours paid for these 20 Holocaust survivors to come to your Montreal book launch.
Yeah.
And they're all like, where would they have that opportunity to come? You've created this opportunity. Like, oh my goodness.
It's even crazier than that. I was invited to go and speak. They have a coffee group weekly, and I was invited to come and speak. And somehow with the dates, I ended up going before the book was even launched. So a couple of weeks ago, they invited me, and I don't have a script yet. I don't have the book to show them. Quickly printed off the manuscript and went on my way. And we had such a great time together that they started asking me that they wanted to come to the book launch. And this is really, one of the women there looked really familiar, Holocaust survivor, probably about 90, looked super familiar. I couldn't place it. Anyway, it turns out that she said, I knew your mother. How did she know my mother? Because my mother was in a nursing home at the end of her life. And this woman had a loved one on the same floor and used to watch us visit my mother. Okay. I never knew she was a Holocaust survivor. And when the talk was over, she said, I'm going to come to your launch because your mother can't be there. Oy. I mean, how do you have a dry eye after that?
Oh my God, Amy.
Yes.
That's unbelievable.
It was, talk about Bashert fate coincidence that brought us together. I was looking at her, how do I know you? And she said, and then she came up to me after and we were just so emotional. And she lived through the war.
Unbelievable. You've created all this. I don't want to give the whole story away, but when Maria finally connects to her relatives because of Stanley and the fact that Maria and Stanley are even related, like that made me flip. I was like, oh my God. But the scene where she's being hugged at the synagogue by 100 of her long lost relatives, it was so heart-wrenching. And as Jeannie Becker says, so heart-swelling at the same time. And you captured the emotion so vividly and evocatively.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
Like it was just, it made me think that this could be a film. Are there thoughts about that?
Thank you. Oh, my thoughts right now are let's just get this thing out in the world. And let's just do what we need to do. Let's just step one. Let's step one at a time. Yeah. I mean, look, to me, it's a story that needs to be told. I want as many people to read it as possible because I think it's so important to recognize the good that people are doing.
100%, Amy. You've captured the enormity and the magnitude of what that must be like. Exactly what you're saying, the joy and the pathos of all of it. Was that hard to write about that? Were you crying as you were writing that part?
I don't cry at my own writing, I have to say. So no, I wasn't crying.
I cried a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad. I've learned that this book has made people cry.
Yeah. Beyond.
I've learned that I've made people cry with this book and people cry at different parts. You know, some people found the kind of more personal parts about my uncle and that story very touching. Some people found the story of the baby and how she was left and that part very touching. So I think it's not a long book, but it takes you in a lot of directions.
It takes you on a real journey. You started writing the book in 2019,
yes,
which was way before October 7th.
Yes.
You continued writing during all of October 7th and long after. Did writing this book about a Holocaust survivor impact your experience even more deeply of October 7th? Like, did it just reverberate for you?
Listen, I have family in Israel and very good friends, as many of us in the community do. And what was the most impactful for me is that my friends there are dealing with everything about having teenage daughters and having teenage daughters fighting in a war. One of them was called back and couldn't go to her Taylor Swift concert because she was called back into the army. And it just really brought home, yes, that's what 19, 20-year-olds care about. Yeah. That's what 21-year-olds care about. I'm supposed to be in Portugal at Taylor Swift, but now I can't go because I've been called up. So for me, the whole experience was really personal. I think the whole war was a heartbreak and continues to be a heartbreak. And there's nothing that could make it better or worse for me. It's just been survival mode, I think. How it relates to this book is a lot of writers have had experiences of anti-Semitism and people were worried for me that I wouldn't be able to get it published. My gratitude to Goose Lane. I mean, whenever I had my initial calls with them, I tried not to cry on the calls because it wouldn't be professional. But I just kept saying, thank you so much. And thank you. And thank you for taking a chance on me. Because my editor too, you know, like I said, Fredericton. So I was explaining what a challah bread is. Things that most Torontonians or Montrealers would know.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure. 100%. Oh my God. Oh yeah, bagels are in this book. The other interesting thing I just want to tell the listeners is that you have a full-time job. I want to explain this. You have a full-time job and you've said, and I quote, writing is something I do for fun. So this book took me 6 years to research and write. Still, I find it blissful.
Yes.
Can you say more about that? I think it's going to actually be profitable though in this case, but
I don't know.
That aside, that's not why you do it.
I don't know. Look, I really like my job, but writing for me is a passion project. I really like to learn different aspects. Like Honeymoon Sneakers was a poetry collection that I published last year. You know, I'm always kind of trying to do something different. I had it in my mind that I would like to be more literary and this is my literary moment.
Your family must be so, your dad, oh my God, and your mom is watching over you. It was heart-wrenching to read about all the twists and turns and dead ends. I've mentioned this. It took place before Stanley was able to connect Maria to her relatives and help her find her identity. And again, this mirrored for me how you don't become an overnight sensation writing a book. it's just like her journey, like his journey. It was not a simple thing. Like, hi, I'm going to do 23andMe. I'm going to do this.
Exactly. You know,
it was twists. It was turns. It was dead ends. It was like, I found that part of it almost like I was dying. Like I was on the edge of my seat. Is this going to work? Is this going to happen? Is something like, it's not working. How is she going to find her relatives? And as you were writing it, did you feel the incredible frustration that Stanley must have felt and Maria in order to crack this case wide open? Because you really captured that in the narrative, that it was just compelling and it was...
Well, I mean, listen, the funny thing about writing a book is that the material is dry and it's my job to make it read compelling. So the story was not particularly compelling when it was given to me. Okay. I was the factory that made it compelling for you, because what I'm looking at is emails and graphs and spreadsheets and missed connections. And I'm taking all that.
Yes.
And I'm going, taking my MFA expertise and a little bit of editor expertise. And we're kind of coming up with something that then reads compelling. But the inputs, you know, the salt and the baking powder and the flour are not as good as the chocolate cake at the end, if that makes sense.
Right. That's right. Well, you've captured it so evocatively and excitingly in this narrative. It's so beautifully written. I asked you if it's going to become a film. I know that's down the road, but I could see it. What is your advice to budding writers? I know you once said you missed an opportunity because you waited on something and you wanted to be on some podcast. It didn't happen right away for you because you felt a bit anxious about how you're going to, and we all do this, right? We procrastinate because it's not going to be good enough. It's not going to be great enough. Is this part of your advice to young writers is just go for it? We're going to take a short commercial break and find out all about that when we come back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And just before the break, I was asking you, Amy, about your advice for young writers.
My advice to young writers really would be go for it, but also you need to build a network. It looks like writing is something that you do in a vacuum by yourself at your desk, but I don't really think that's correct. I think the more you go out and go to conferences and writing like book launches and speakers and kind of build your writing community, the better chance you have of success. Because first of all, it's important to share your work with other writers and have people look at it. Second of all, because you want to give back to the community, like I do with Hippocampus, doing interviews and book reviews for them. That's not a financial thing. We're all volunteers at the magazine. And we do that because we want to promote creative nonfiction. And I think for budding writers, find your community, whatever it is, whether it's romance writers, whether it's mystery writers, whether it's nonfiction writers, and try and grow within a community, because you'll give back and you'll get more out of it.
That's fabulous. I know you've expressed how heartbreaking it is that Stanley's not here to enjoy this. He passed away on December 18th, 2024, but this is his legacy and you've created this legacy for him. I mean, that's amazing in itself. And you've described how sad it made you feel that he would never have the opportunity to hold the finished product in his hand, the actual book. What do you think he would have said about all of this?
I think he would have been delighted that it saw the light of day. I think he knew that he gave a pretty decent contribution to the world of genealogy, and it was important to him that that was recorded. I think he also had a lot of people he wanted to thank. And look, we were lucky. He wrote the foreword and he knew this was coming. And I just got word yesterday that his daughter is going to be at the Toronto launch. So that was also really big news. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. That is incredible.
Yeah. I know. I'm so happy.
I can't wait. I'm going to be there. So I can't wait. I can't wait to see you speak and read from the book and to meet her. I also wondered, because I follow you on Instagram, what your husband Dave said after he read the book. I saw him reading it on Instagram and I wondered what was his reaction.
You know, it's funny, eh? Because my husband is super camera shy and just generally a more introverted type of person. So for me to have him on camera saying, "What did you think of my book?" is like he's frozen. He looks at me in the video and says, "What do I say? Like, what did I think of this book?" I think two things resonated for him. First of all, he was really surprised at how much research I personally did. He was really surprised. It's one thing to say, yeah, I write research nonfiction. It's another to understand that every single fact in that book has been checked at least and backed up by at least three or four different. So every time I say, and this is my big example, it was snowing. That means I looked at weather reports.
Yes.
Each thing took so long. That's how we got to 6 years. Yes. And I think yes. That was really surprising for Dave. And then the other thing was, you know, I thank people in my acknowledgments and he said he can't believe how many of these people he doesn't know. And when I talk about writing community, that's what I'm talking about. I'm standing here, but I have all my writers behind me and in back of me and in front of me and propping me up. And I do that for them. And we help each other. And my writing community is based on Hippocampus Magazine, that group, and my MFA group. And those two really powerful groups, plus online, I'm on an online writing group too. All those three groups are really strong at the end of the day. And I thank everybody. And he was really surprised. So those were his two kind of comments.
You're going to have even more because you're going to have the genealogy community.
Yeah.
And you're going to have the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You're going to have many, many more.
Yeah.
Amy, we had another author on our show recently who is the child of the Holocaust survivors, Elizabeth Rosner. She wrote a book called The Third Ear about deep listening. It's her sixth book. And she said, when a book is over, it's never really over. It keeps writing itself
and
it keeps on taking a life of its own.
She's right.
Are you finding that with 1 in 6 million?
Well, The thing is, that's why you have to make sure you love your topic. Because like this summer, I was just invited to the International Association of Jewish Genealogy Societies. And I'm going and my talk is about how to tell your story as a genealogist so that future generations will be able to read the research you've done. And I have to be passionate about that because I'm going to go there and I'm going to tell people how to tell their stories. You know what I mean? So yeah, like it does have a life of its own afterward because then you're doing, and it kind of builds and builds and builds. And before you know it, you're in Des Moines or wherever it is.
You're in Des Moines. Is there a moment in the book that stays with you that you can't get out of your mind? Something that just, I always say fleeting memories or images or sounds or sights or a feeling or a word or a line that stays with you long after.
It's amazing to me that even after Maria found out her family and found out what happened to her parents and found everything out, she still did not know her birth name. It was the last piece of the puzzle. They suspected that Maria, being more of a Catholic choice, was given to her as a decoy. And that turned out to be true.
Yeah.
And so the last thing that she found out was her Hebrew name.
Wow. And that's such a part of your identity.
Yeah.
That's everything.
Yeah.
Like even meeting all the cousins, 100 people and knowing where and when and parents' names and aunts and uncles and all of it, not knowing your name. Your name is your name.
That's it. And she still didn't know. It was the last thing. So that really stayed with me. She told me that it was like a puzzle piece that was fit in. And so that's very visual, right? I sort of imagine an empty puzzle piece in her heart and the puzzle piece got placed in and now the jigsaw is complete.
A hole in her heart and he helped fill it.
That's how she felt. That is really how she felt. And she still lives in Siberia and she still goes by Maria.
Wow.
She didn't change her name, but it was good to know.
Also to know that the people that found her and took her and adopted her or embraced her and not a Jewish family, not a Jewish couple, like it just shows that there's so much goodness.
Yeah. And how scary it must have been for them. Gestapo everywhere, rifles ready to go, and they hear some mewling. They look, it's an actual baby. Imagine they probably had no time to think. When I watch that in my head, it's like, baby, scoop.
Yeah.
And how many of us would do that? How many of us would walk by a baby on the side of the road, pick her up and be like, okay, well, I guess we have a daughter now.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Is there a golden nugget that you would like people to take away from this book? Is there something that you want to really impart to people reading this book, One in 6 Million?
I think the most important thing that I want people to get out of it is that each of us have a responsibility to make the world a better place and a brighter place. Mm-hmm. And just like Stanley did, just like Maria's parents did, there are so many characters in the book. There's a priest who was saving babies, stashing them in the church belfry. You know, there are so many characters that just risked everything for someone else. And I think if they could do that, you can call your grandma and see how she's doing. Or whatever it's like, whatever that translates for you.
It's really, really incredible stuff. Amy, we talked about, we're going to say at the end of the show again, that the book is being published, One in 6 Million, on April the 1st. And there's going to be a book launch in Toronto. So just check out Amy Fish Writes to find out where and when. And April 3rd, there will be a book launch in Montreal that I think is going to be pretty heavy stuff. I just want to go back again. Like, media is going to be in full force, I'm sure, for all these things. When your great uncle Avi died, you were very much in the media because he was this guy that would go and help people who didn't have a bicycle. He would go and get people bicycles. Could you tell us more about
it? Sure. My uncle Avi did not have a bike when he was young because his parents could not afford a bike. And it really bothered him. Everyone in the neighborhood had a bike and he couldn't afford a bike. So when he got old enough, when he became an adult and he was successful, he said, I'm going to buy bikes for the kids of Montreal. And he contacted an organization called Sun Youth, which was really grassroots. And it was in the neighborhood that he grew up in. And he donated bikes. And it grew to be an annual program where he would donate, up until this year, we still do it, 100 bikes. And then it became, along with bike helmets, and it came along with locks. And I had the opportunity to go to the ceremony where the kids get the bikes and the police come and teach them about road safety. And then they're taught how to lock up their bike and how to be careful. And there are students, there are young kids that are selected by their social workers, by their community workers to get these bikes. And he was known in Montreal as the bike man. And no one knew who he was. It was an anonymous program. When he passed away and the identity of the bike man was revealed. Yeah. We were all over the news.
And you spoke on his behalf.
Yes.
You were the one that went on TV and radio and in print. And you were
my
you
sister
and your
family. And I, were, my sister,
your
and
sister
I,
and you.
Yeah.
Your sister and you were the two people.
My sister gave the eulogy, and I gave part of it. But my sister really was the main person, and our kids were all pallbearers because we're a very close family, and it was a big loss for us. And so to imagine that he gave me this story at his Shiva, I mean. It's just
unbelievable. Yeah. It's just, again, it's the word that Stanley loved. It's beshert, it's fate, it's meant to be.
Yeah.
And also you come from a line of givers and people who give back and people who make the world a better place. So that made it even, resonated even more. Amy, I've asked you this question before, as is tradition on this show. And so, of course, I'm going to ask it to you again. What is bliss these days for Amy Fish?
You know what? I have a prop. I forgot the question. But I'm so excited to roll up the rim. I mean, I'm joking, but really the bliss for me is in the smaller things right now. I find that I'm getting pleasure in really the smallest little things, whether it's a FaceTime with one of my kids, whether it's rolling up the actual paper rim. So excited about that. Whether it's friends of mine that are really supporting the book. Thank you for this interview and other people that are doing that for me. That's really where my bliss is. I find my world is small right now, and I'm really focused on the very small things.
I love that. I also want to just mention to everyone, and you did mention this, but for those that might be tuning in later, every Monday you put out a Substack called Persistence for Writers. So writers out there, you know, they always say everyone wants to direct, everyone wants to be a director, but I really think everybody really wants to be a writer. So, and this Persistence for Writers is about how to keep going when you'd rather do anything but. And for those who don't know what Substack means, if anyone doesn't know that, it's a subscription-based platform that lets writers publish newsletters and other content directly to their audience. Can you describe what that is? Because you write some incredible stuff in it. What is Substack and how can people connect to it and connect to yours specifically?
Sure. So the easiest way to connect to anything with me is through Instagram, Amy Fish Writes, and I post the links all the time, and the link to my Substack is in my bio. So that's the easiest.
Awesome.
Okay.
Awesome.
Substack is a newsletter. Mine is free. It will always be free. This is me giving back in this way, which is I'm motivated and I have enough motivation to share. So I want to keep other people, particularly writers, motivated to tell their stories because we need to hear them.
That's so fabulous. Amy, what is the best way to get a copy of your book, 1 in 6 Million?
1 in 6 Million is available right now on Goose Lane Editions, Indigo, Amazon, wherever you're buying your books, you should be able to pre-order it. And after April 1st, it will be in stores, knock wood. And great. Everyone who comes so to the exciting. Launch will get a copy of the book and I will sign it for you.
So excited. And tell us again about your social media, how people can get in touch with you on social media.
The best way to get in touch with me on social media is Instagram. That's my favorite. It's very visual. I really like it. I spend a bit of time on Facebook, but my heart is on Instagram and Substack. You know, Substack has very interesting newsletters. Most of them are free. Like I said, mine is free. And I'm pretty consistent. I started it a year ago at the beginning of January 2024, and I've managed to do it almost every single Monday.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Amy, I'm really proud of you.
Thanks, Jude. Thank you.
This is really unbelievable.
Thank you.
And it's really been an honor to have you back on the show. All these years later,
I know.
You're one of the first guests ever. And here you are in season 6. But look what you've done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's been so wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Each week, we spotlight a fabulous person like Amy Fish, who is living their bliss and helping other people live their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, meditation, mindfulness expert, therapist, life coach, actor, dancer, writer, singer, anyone who's found and is following their bliss, we would love to hear from you. Just reach out to us at fyb@findingyourbliss.com. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the bliss coach. That means I help you get unstuck, gain clarity, and find your passion and purpose. Reach out to me at findyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. In Bliss News, I'm so excited to announce that I'm involved in a very exciting event as part of Canada Israel Fashion Week. It's their highly anticipated Fashion Blooms event. And Canadian Hadassah Wheatso has partnered with Canada Israel Fashion Week to unveil the highly anticipated Fashion Blooms event. The evening will dazzle with a spectacular runway show featuring exclusive collections from two acclaimed Israeli designers, Mesquite and Hannah Morellis, and a special scene featuring community runway models wearing fabulous styles by local designer Millie. The event will also showcase the cutting-edge designs by the talented graduates of the CHW-supported Neri Bloomfield School of Design. This promises to be the fashion event of the season. Fashion Blooms will also include live entertainment, an open bar, gourmet hors d'oeuvres, great swag, and access to the market, an exclusive shopping experience supporting Jewish and Israeli-owned businesses. Fashion Blooms is in support of psychological and physical rehabilitation programs at Hadassah Hospital and specialized PTSD treatment at Shamir Medical Center, who are at the forefront of trauma recovery efforts. Proceeds will also support Canadian Young Judea's JOLT program in Canada to foster leadership development, Jewish identity, and community outreach. I will be co-hosting the Fashion Blooms event along with my beautiful daughter, singer and musical theater actress Lily Liebrack, who is based in New York City, but she is coming to Toronto and we both will be co-hosting this beautiful event. And Lily will also be singing. Tickets are selling out fast. To get your tickets, just go online to chw.ca/fashion-blooms. I'll repeat that again. Just go online to chw.ca/fashion-blooms and hope to see you all there. I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Amy Fish, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yanisiello, Ben Thomas, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.